Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Patricia Lundberg, Professor Emeritus and a women's study professor, and we're going to talk tonight about the origins of the education of women. This is part of the Ascent of Women program here for August at the club, and we Monday Night Philosophy cooperated by getting a topic that was in line with that. I find it a fascinating topic. I'll talk about it a little bit later. Patty's going to talk about, you know, the sort of modern development of the education of women, and I'm going to talk just for a short amount of time before we take questions and answers and have a discussion about it, about the ancient sources and the very unusual reasons why women started to be educated, just by a few people here and there, and they stood out as islands, and they stayed that way for a long period of time. But they also were embedded into Western culture and were relied upon at later periods of time when they went back to educating not only women, but men too. So without any further ado, Patty Lundberg.
Thank you, George. I am a Commonwealth member, and I'm honored to be one. I'm especially honored to be standing here. This is not the kind of thing I usually do. I usually just want to attend these lectures, not give one. What I'm going to do tonight is race through time in Western civilization, and I will have nothing really new to tell you about the history of women's education over Western civilization, so it's by way of reminder. What I will do new is fit myself into this tradition of women's education for the 40 or so years in which I've been discovering that there is a history of women's education and discovering why some of the things that have occurred in my life have greatly influenced me. So yes, I am a feminist. Yes, I have a philosophy of life that is feminist, which means equal opportunity for women. And yes, there's a very long history of women being subordinated by a dominant class, men. Education is a class issue. Poor men and poor women do not fit in the system of education that was developed over all these years because they were not among the elite. So here's the acid test for me. I'm greatly indebted, by the way, to Gerda Lerner, who's a feminist historian who wrote a couple of books in the 80s and 90s called The Creation of Patriarchy and the Rise of Feminist Consciousness. And when I was reading those books, I was teaching and wondering, why weren't we reading some of these histories and some of the literature by women when I was in graduate school? And so I discovered her then, and I'm going to use her very much this evening. So here's the acid test, and it's a quote by Gerda Lerner. We can best express the complexity of women's various levels of dependency and freedom by comparing each woman with her brother and considering how the sisters' and brothers' lives and opportunities would differ. So given all the differences among peoples in different cultures, if it's the same family and the brother and the sister can then be compared in terms of the equal opportunity. And the reason I like this as the acid test is because it was the acid test in my own family. I'm a highly educated woman, almost by accident. When I was growing up, we lived in an urban setting. I have four brothers and a sister, parents who never went to college, who were working once I was, my mother went to work when I was 3 weeks old, and so we went to the school that was within walking distance. It happened that that was a Catholic school with a wonderful, wonderful set of nuns who gave us a fabulous education that I hated at the time. But what happened after the grammar school is the boys went on one track and the girls went on another track. The boys went to the Jesuit high school, which was, I don't know, 30 or 40 miles away, and there was a bus to take them there. The girls went to the closest high school we could find that was accessible by bus and subway. So I took a bus and a subway, and it happened to be an all-girls high school where I got a fabulous education. However, by the time I was a senior, I realized, although I think my parents didn't realize, that this was a college prep school, and all the girls were expected to go to college in the 60s. Well, my parents weren't really prepared by that and for that, and they told me they have four brothers. I had four brothers that they needed to educate, and so I could really forget about college. There wasn't any question of getting loans. We were poor. I don't even know if there were student loans in those days. So I said, well, you know, what if I work really hard and earn some money? And so they actually let me go away to college for a year, as long as I would take secretarial courses, because the object was for me to be able to get a good secretarial job when I finished. So I did. I also majored in Spanish and a whole bunch of other things. Anyway, that was the accident for me, was to get this great college prep education and then find out, well, okay, I could go for a while. So, of course, I quit. I got married. I had kids. I did all those kinds of things because I didn't have any money and they didn't have any money. I got a great job. I was a medical publisher. I worked my way up from secretary to head of the press. Had no problems at all. I had kids by then. So one day I went to my father because I had realized that my brothers were getting educated pretty well and there was a little more money in the family, and I said, hey, Dad, how about if you lend me $10,000 for a year and I'm going to cash in my retirement, take $10,000, finish getting my bachelor's degree, and get a new career? He said, no, honey. Don't be silly. You've got a great job, and you should just stay in that job and support your family. So I cashed in my retirement, freaked my kids out, went back to school, got my bachelor's degree, discovered that they would pay me to go to graduate school, got a fabulous education, got a PhD, was called a housewife scholar through my entire program by the professors there, and the only two people in my graduating PhD class were women who got the tenure track jobs in the entire class. So while I was doing this, I was noticing that my experience wasn't just my experience. And where you stand on a divide between being dominant and being subordinated really influences your philosophy of life and how you look at things. And so I would sit in class during my graduate program and hear people say, well, why aren't we reading Christine de Pizan? Why are we just reading Chaucer? Why not in the 17th century drama? Why are we not reading Aphra Behn instead of just Congreve and Wycherley and and the others? Why is it so hard to find literature for women or by women? So, and then I wrote a book about a woman named Lucas Mallet, who wrote from 1880 to 1930, wrote 18 really good novels. I'm sure you've never heard of her. I think I'm the world's expert on Lucas Mallet because she was completely forgotten. She didn't appear in any of the canons. So when you have this kind of experience, you begin to get upset. So, now, that's why I found Gerda Lerner and other female feminist historians, some men, who tried to recover this long history of women's education so fascinating because it put my own experience in better context. I should also mention that when I got my tenure track job, it was in Indiana in a very poor, very diverse environment where most of the students went to school full time and worked full time. And I found that as an English professor and as a professor of women's studies, I kept running into young and older women who had returned to school to get a degree or to get more skills so they could get better jobs in an environment that was economically depressed. So they would tell me stories about just before an exam, their husband would lock their textbooks in the trunk of the car to make it difficult, or their husbands were really threatened by them being in school at all. And so when you hear that enough times in this kind of environment, you begin to think that we haven't come that far at all. Well, we really have come that far. In the campus that I'm talking about, as recently as 3-5 years ago, 65% of the undergraduate students were women. And so the deans would say, we need more men. And I would say, isn't it fabulous that 65% of the student body is female? But everybody there was struggling. So I will take us through history a little bit. And I will say, education over history has been a class issue. If you weren't a member of the elite, boy or girl, man or woman, you were highly likely to be uneducated and illiterate. So Gerda Lerner takes us back to Sumerian and Babylonian culture 2,000, 3,000 years ago, and she says this, and I'm quoting her, "From Sumerian and Babylonian culture in the second millennium BC to Sparta in classical antiquity to the monastic system of education in Europe, girls were disadvantaged in every known society of the Western world in regard to the length of their training, the content they were taught, and the skills of their teachers. This followed logically from the purposes of education, since women were excluded from military, religious, and political elites. They were considered to have little need for formalized training. On the other hand, daughters of the elites, such as princesses, noble women, Elizabeth I, for example, who might have to serve as stand-ins for sons or husbands, stand-in queen, were carefully tutored and trained as well as their brothers were. During the Middle Ages, the content of their learning was the same, and they often shared tutors with their brothers. Education was a class privilege, I keep saying that. It's not surprising, therefore, to find that almost all the known educated women from antiquity, Western world, to the 16th century were members of the nobility." So, in Western civilization, we started with men in a dominant position. Gerda Lerner argues that there were no matriarchies, that when we read about queens and shared wealth and shared rule among some of these cultures, we're really talking about those exceptions of the stand-in queens, of the daughters who are educated to go be among the captured culture, to be a spy, to be a representative, to be a diplomat. And when they appear, for example, in the list of kings, they are the exception and the elites. In the age of the patriarchs, 600 BC, we know through our study of Genesis, Louis Epstein, for example, has done that. It was considered a primary religious need for the boys to be formally educated in the Torah, but there wasn't any obligation in regard to girls. It wasn't kept from them, but there was no formal obligation. In classical Greece, Gerda Lerner argues, for Aristotle, women were mutilated men. So that got me going. He justifies slavery by comparing it to marriage, with wives ministering to the needs of life, as do slaves. Plato, however, in the Republic, accepted the strong governing of the weak and the inequality of people, men and women, he envisioned women as equals if they were among the elite guardian class to be bred along with the elite men who would be the guardians in the Republic, so a utopian society, a benevolent dictatorship. During the Roman Republic, there's some evidence that women were well-educated, and they educated both their boys and their girls. In the Middle Ages, from the 7th to the 12th, 13th century in Europe, formal learning could be acquired only through tutors or in religious institutions. I'm going to have quite a bit to say about the religious institutions. For a long time, learned women appear only in convents. And during this time, a lot of convents, a lot of abbeys with powerful abbesses and abbots, taught girls. But again, this was a class issue, because unless the girl's family had a dowry to pay, those girls were not going to be educated in that convent. For boys, they, of course, were being educated for service in the ministry or generally for religious life or the military or whatever. However, parish priests began to teach poor boys. They would take poor boys so that they could educate them for the clergy. So even there, the poor boys could get educated, but the poor girls were not. But because of these abbeys and convents, powerful abbesses, a tradition of learning developed, and a tradition of female scholarship developed. And the religious houses would train their own novitiates. They would train daughters of the nobility, the rising bourgeoisie, if they could pay the dowry. They would learn Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. And they would learn all these so that they could then understand biblical texts. So when the biblical texts began to be published in the vernacular, there wasn't so much of a need for girls to learn Latin and Greek and Hebrew. So Gerda Lerner has a lot to say about the universities as being detrimental to the education of girls. So along about the 13th and 14th century, when the universities began to be developed, this is all Western Europe, preparing young men for the ministry and for service in the, to the state. In order to attend universities, they need to master Latin. So they'd go to prep schools to master Latin. So the girls didn't need Latin, so they wouldn't go to the prep schools. Then along about 1534 in England, Henry VIII came along and abolished the abbeys, which meant that this long tradition of learning, at least in England, was abolished when the abbeys were closed. So boys then could go to schools, but the girls could only be trained by tutors. I'm not sure whether that was covert or not, but closing the abbeys really had a detrimental effect on the education of girls for about 100 years. Not so long. But during the Protestant Reformation, there were a lot of schools that were opened, eventually both for boys and for girls. And girls really were able to go to school, but what they learned was more simplified. There were fewer schools than there were for boys, and so the detrimental effects of women, girls' education continued to be a problem. So I have two examples of women that I actually, somewhere along the line, got to study. A tradition developed of women writing histories of women, in part to deflect the misogynist texts that they were reading. In many elite households, girls and women were educated because their fathers had great libraries, because their fathers supported their learning, because, like Elizabeth I, she was being groomed to be in service. So Sir Thomas More, for example, educated his daughters. So there are a number of examples of learned women at the time. And one of these was Christine de Pizan. And she wrote the book of the City of Ladies. And she built this city of women in history by rewriting Boccaccio's history of women, noted women. And Christine de Pizan created an allegorical city in which she sort of rewrote Boccaccio, and the women who weren't quite so good in Boccaccio became a lot better in Christine de Pizan. But she specifically wrote it as a response to a really misogynist text, French text, called The Romance of the Rose, which when I read Christine de Pizan, I had to go back and read The Romance of the Rose. I have to tell you, it is really, really, really long and really, really, really misogynist. So within Christine, this is 1405, she wrote the book of the City of Ladies. And in it, she's arguing strongly that women, are girls, are capable of learning. So all of this long tradition of women being felt to be inferior, she's debunking that by listing, one after the other, a number of noted, capable, learned, good women. Her women are good. And the main point she's making is that women have the capacity to learn and should be allowed to learn. So another example of this is in 1668, English woman named Mary Astell, who proposed a convent for women to form a learning community. And it's not unlike the abbeys with the abbesses and their novitiates and the girls going to learn there. But Mary Astell proposed forming this non-Catholic convent of learning for women. And it's part of a long history of communities of women, oases, if you will, for women to live in a network of women where they can bounce ideas off one another and learn and not have to ever say, ever hide their learning. I'll never forget when I was in graduate school and one of my woman professors on the first day of class said something like, "We don't ever have to play dumb again." Which kind of, you know, then she turned out to be one of the hardest professors I ever had. So she was really into intellectual development. So at any rate, Gerda Lerner argues that in these communities of women, or in these instances of noted women that she was detailing in her books, they tend to be widowed, unmarried, or sequestered in some way, so that the women who were able, or did, in retrospect, did accomplish whatever it was that they accomplished and became learned, they were not hindered, if you will, by all the kinds of things that tend to interrupt women's lives over time. So, in that sense, also in the 17th and 18th century, salons developed where women of learning could gather together and men of learning as well. One in particular in England, which included Mary Herbert, Countess of Pembroke, who's a sister of Sir Philip Sidney, included Spencer, Shakespeare, John Donne, all mingling together, sparring, but in a social space where intellectual life was a feature of their days. Now, John Locke, in the 17th century, we all know, who gave us the ideas of the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and property, asserted, according to Lerner, that women's subordination to man within the family was natural and antedated organized society. Thus, men had paternal power over women. Rousseau When I was writing my book about Lucas Mallett, there's a wonderful letter in her private papers where she's describing to her sister that she was reading something, but she had Rousseau handy so that if her husband came in the room, she could take out Rousseau and do exactly this. The purpose of women's education should be to learn to love her duties toward men and to carry them out intelligently and cheerfully. And that was pretty much what was in Lucas Mallett's letter. Okay, so 18th century, 19th century, development of lots of communities of learning for women. And in the 19th century, women really were able to go to school. So the middle of the 19th century, there's one law after another, one country after another, women are allowed to learn. So great strides. The first co-ed university in the United States, Oberlin, 1833, Mount Holyoke, 1837, which is the first of the seven sisters. In England, Queen's College, 1848, same year as the Seneca Falls Convention, which is widely thought to be the beginning of the women's movement in the United States. Well, that's only the latest women's movement. There was one in the, you know, there's a whole round of them. We just don't know about all of them. But the Seneca Falls Convention had as one of its planks that equal opportunity for women's education had to be part of the New World. Girton College, 1869. Oxford's Lady Margaret Hall, 1879. Newnham College, 1875. But it wasn't until 1882 in Great Britain that women even were allowed to have an adult entity, allowed to hold property, allowed to get divorced, allowed to have custody of their children, because tied up in the entire history of the education of women in Western civilization is the idea that they weren't capable of taking care of their own affairs. So that by 1882, they were capable, and it for me, it just fits right in with the idea that women now have apparently a natural right to go to school. In the late 19th century, because of the higher education issues, with women now being okay to get educated, still not being able to go to the universities, a great disparity, an institutionalized disparity in the education of boys and in the education of women. So one of the complaints that Gerda Lerner is making in her histories of the education of women is that even when women were allowed to get into graduate school and they would study things like women's history, they had more trouble getting research money, more trouble getting career positions. Their work was marginalized, ignored, or dissed during tenure, and I can attest to that. Even in the 90s, 80s, and 90s, in universities, it still was marginalized research, and when you can't get the research funding, it's difficult all the way around. For example, in the 1990s. When I was trying to find my next career, I wanted to go to medical school. And the advisor said, forget it. You're too old. And you know, you've got kids. And so forget it. So I became an English professor and loved every minute of it. All right. So I'd like to sum up. That was then, and this is now. In the developed world, women have surpassed men at many, many levels of education. I don't really want them to surpass men. I always want equal opportunity, equal access. Until 1837, women were unable to enroll in any college or university. By 1870, they constituted 21% of the total undergraduate enrollment. By 1880, women constituted 32% of the undergraduate student body. And by 1910, almost 40%. Big gains. But it wasn't until 1920, when women were 47% of the college undergraduates, that women achieved equal access to a college education with men. In graduate enrollments, the low point in the 20th century came in 1960, when my father was telling me, get a secretarial degree, when women were 35% of all students with a bachelor's or a first professional degree, and only 10% of doctorates. Now, in the United States, women earn more than two-thirds of associate degrees, more than 60% of bachelor's degrees, 60% of master's degrees, and half of doctorates. So huge, huge gains for women. So I would like to close with a quote, not close, but bring on George, who I'm sure will set me straight, with another quote from Lerner. Throughout historical time, women have been discriminated against and disadvantaged economically, politically, legally, and sexually. They have, depending on their class, race, and ethnic affiliations with men, also participated in discriminating against, disadvantaging, and exploiting men and women different from themselves by race and class and religion. So we still have a lot to learn. And depending on which side of that divide you're on, the dominant class, the subordinate class, the lucky class, the class with opportunity, or the class that still needs opportunity, really influences how you think, how you feel, how you develop your own personal philosophy of life. So, George?
Even the dog loved that. Quiet until I had to talk. Thanks a lot, Patty. That was just great, and I have nothing to change from that. I would like to talk about something slightly different for just a second, and that is, you know, what were the impetuses of some of the men that were mentioned, you know, for educating women? Why did this get started? As you say, almost never occurred for thousands of years. And as Patty rightfully puts out, most of the time men weren't educated either. It was a class issue. Maybe I'm not quite as optimistic even with those numbers for the long term, but the reason that I say that is because people find a different issue. It doesn't have to do with class, doesn't have to do with race, it doesn't have to do with anything except for our own personal psychology, and that is people want to feel more important than other people. That's a serious drive on all kinds of scales, and people do a lot of different things in very small ways in order to say, I'm more important than somebody else. And with that drive, you are always looking for a reason for that. There's a very common experience that we say that almost everybody knows about that reason, that is that, you know, you create gods and then you discover their clay feet and you drag them back down into the mud with you again. And the reason for that, I think, is very simple, and that is you want to have heroes to some extent, but basically you want to then have a conclusion or a set of facts on which you can say, but I'm glad I'm not them. I'm living a better life than they are. Because although they may be a movie star or they may be president of the United States, but at least I don't do that dumb thing that they do or that dumb thing that they do. And I think people tend to think that way about everybody around them all the time. It's a very standard way of thinking. So because of that, until people find their importance in some other way other than comparing themselves with other people, I think there'll always be something, maybe it'll be the size of our noses or something, that will allow us to feel better than the other person. But that said, there's some interesting stories about some of the people that had a strong influence in Western culture on educating women. You mentioned Sir Thomas More. There's a classic scene in the movie about his life, based on the play by Robert Bold, A Man for All Seasons. There's a classic scene where he where Henry VIII comes to visit, and he's introduced to the eldest daughter of Thomas More, who's played, by the way, by a very beautiful young actress at the time. I can't remember which one. So, and that's not very realistic, because we've seen the pictures of his daughters. But this daughter addressed Henry VIII in Latin, which, of course, Henry VIII knew, so he was impressed. Then she began to speak in Greek with him, and then he didn't want to talk anymore. So it was, and she actually was so well-educated that she found some of the mistakes in Erasmus's book in translating the New Testament from the ancient Greek, from the ancient Greek over. So she was extremely well-educated in Greek and Latin, very good student of languages. And just the same way that some husbands would put the textbooks into the trunk of the car so that you couldn't achieve yourself, Henry VIII was impressed up to a point where it was an amusement, but when it was no longer amusing, that was the end of it. So, but Sir Thomas More, where did Sir Thomas More get the idea from? He was, of course, a Platonist. He loved Plato, and Plato, of course, in the Republic, educated women. Now, as Patty points out, it was the educated class or the elite class that got educated, but nobody got educated other than the elite class at the time. So it was also a very, very big step to take, but it wasn't original to Plato either. It was original to Pythagoras. Plato was also a Pythagorean, and Pythagoras lived 150 years earlier than that. Why did Pythagoras, I've talked about this before in other circumstances, but why did Pythagoras educate women? And there's a very nice statistic. There aren't a lot of statistics like this from the ancient world, but about 800 years after Pythagoras lived, so maybe in the 250s AD, one of the Pythagoreans collected the names of the most influential Pythagorean thinkers in the last 800 years since Pythagoras' time. And on that list of a little bit over 300 people, there are 53 women. 53 women. Not two or three, 53, 17%. Not a shabby number. And why? Because he educated women. And right from the start, Pythagoras educated women. Now, why did he do that? Well, there's a couple of reasons. Some of them very interesting and practical, and another that's very, very esoteric. So one of the reasons he did was because his mother was responsible for his own education. His mother was an educated elite, an uneducated elite person who wanted a good education, saw she had a smart son, and decided that she'd send him off to learn everything he could possibly learn and come back and tell her everything. So she sent him off to Egypt and Babylon, and he studied from all the educated elites of the time and then came back. And the father was a trader, so they knew the whole roots of the area and stuff like that. They knew people in all the ports. He came back maybe after 10 years or so, and he told his mother what he wanted. But then he married a very intelligent woman, and he trained her, educated her, and then they had daughters, and he educated them, and he let women into his secret society. And you know, it shows how dangerous education was at the time, was that Pythagoras had to keep his education of practical things about science and everything secret. He wouldn't let only people who he trusted would he start to tell about mathematics. I mean, it's not the same as the way we look at things today, and I think you can get a good insight into the time to realize that accurate scientific approach towards things was a dangerous thing on all levels of society. And after a while, he was kicked out of places where he had a lot of political influence because he didn't let the political leaders in. They weren't good enough or trustworthy enough individuals. Nothing has changed in 2,000 years. So that's part of the background. The other part of the background of why he educated women is a little more esoteric. Pythagoras was a believer in reincarnation, which was also extremely unusual in ancient Greece, and he claimed to be able to remember his past lives. And one of the past lives that he remembered was as a prostitute, a female prostitute. And he found that he had been very, very badly abused in those circumstances, and he wanted to do something for people who were currently in that state, and he wanted to educate them. So part of his belief in the education of women originated from the fact that he believed he had previously been a woman and that he didn't like it a whole lot. So Plato, it's a little like, you know, the Mormons are very good at genealogy because of their beliefs, and Newton, you know, gave us a lot of very good scientific things when he was trying actually to discover the alchemic method of turning lead into gold. So I think it's a very important part of history to figure out what was really motivating people. And this was a big motivator. Now, Plato, among the fact that he educated women, one of the things he said, which wasn't as harsh as Aristotle, his student, but he did say, "I am very happy that I was born Greek and not a barbarian. I'm very happy that I was born at this time rather than another time, and I'm very happy that I was born a man and not a woman." So it's you know, obviously there are advantages, but the education of women has proven, obviously, that sex hasn't got anything to do with the educability of the person that inhabits that body, as Pythagoras might say. And I'll just put one small personal story in to add to Patty's, because my mother is 20 years before Patty, and she had six brothers and two sisters. One of the sisters became a Catholic nun and then went on to teach at Patty School, maybe. And the other sister did not get educated. My mother was valedictorian of her high school class, best student of all the boys. All the boys became engineers. They were all pretty smart guys. But she didn't go to college. 1943 graduate, didn't go to college, having been valedictorian of her high school class. So guess what my mom wanted for all 12 of us in our family? A college education. That was her main goal for us in life. She didn't care anything else. She just had to get a college education because it's what she didn't get. So. That's the background I wanted to share about the reasons why some, because there's a difference between Western culture on this issue and Asian cultures on this issue, and the reason for it is just a few people who thought differently and that they made progress at different points, and so that there was some kind of precedent. Now, of course, we have really big precedent. And I think, interestingly enough, if I can make a prediction about the future, it will be economics that will make this a powerful and irreplaceable right, or at least until the economics all falls apart. And that's because the economies that ignore 50% of the value of their population are going to not be competitive with those who don't ignore it. So, that will take 200 or 300 years to prove, but I think it's already obvious. People who worry about different cultures taking over the world economy and so on, they should look at that basic idea and see how far it has progressed in that country. And there are differences. I mean, there's a difference between China and Japan, for example. In my business experience in both places, Chinese are quite willing to have women in business positions, in top business positions, and I have never seen a top Japanese businesswoman. And that's totally unnecessary, but that's still a very strong part of that culture, and that will hurt them in the long run. There's no question about it, and eventually it will be noticed. The numbers will be noticed. So that's a prediction. Now, questions for Patty. No, for Patty.
It was interesting. Just this weekend, I picked up a book by Deborah Tannen.
Yeah.
And she wrote, what is it, You Just Don't Understand Me? But this book is called Combative Versus Conversation. And I was just thinking, there's so much suppression that I just sense. I come from East County right now, and I sense it very strongly in the Delta area, where certain areas there's just a strong suppression of women and not to go to school. And I remember when I was doing summer internships, a family of 10, and my intern was the first one to be able to get to college from Oakland Tech High School. And just the title of this book, I haven't read it yet, but I just, you know, invite all of us to maybe explore this. And this can go all around the world, this issue of being combative and trying to prove you're better than somebody else, and the put-down sometimes that we endure, or maybe that we unconsciously put out ourselves, and just so that we can have more dialogue instead wherever we come from.
I think Deborah Tannen is a good one to read, too. She shifts, I haven't read her in some time, but she shifts between scholarly work and work for the general public. I'm pretty sure she wrote Men Are From Mars. And who is that? Oh, of course. Yeah. Yes.
You can come on and sit down if you want to join. I know that some people are getting out of the other lecture.
Talking from 9 to 5.
Yeah, that was the other book.
I have two things. I can explain something about Johnny Gray, even though he was an aside. But If you discuss the education over a long period of time and combative versus, I think that one of the keys, a key idea that's going to really help along this line, is if everybody would start to become aware that whenever you try to cheat or, you know, work dishonestly in any competition, you are admitting that you're not feeling competitive. Right? So when you get combative, when you try to shove down the other person and not listen to him, you are admitting that you don't think that you can discuss the idea rationally with somebody.
Well, you
absolutely are, but it's a male thing, and I mean it's not only a male thing. I shouldn't say that because lots of people use it, but I think, you know, we have addressed cheating and stealing and everything as some moral issue. I think we should start to address it as an insight into human personality and what we're revealing about ourselves, because that will be more devastating to the habit than any moral or ethical answer. Because you don't have all you have to do is realize that you're giving away your whole weakness by doing it, and that will stop a lot of competitive men, at least, and other very competitive people from using that approach. And now Johnny Gray is interesting because he's written about these subjects. I happen to know Johnny Gray personally. I knew him in Switzerland when he was 18, 19 years old, and he spoke at the club just a year ago or 2 years ago, and I hadn't seen him in about 25 years. So we chatted afterwards, and I said, you know, Johnny, I have a theory about why you succeeded in explaining all this stuff. And he says, oh, try it on me, because I have my own theory about it. And Johnny and I both were studying at the time with a man called Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, a guru from the 60s, and he had set up in Switzerland. And Johnny was working for him directly, and he had pledged all of his time and effort to that program for 8 or 9 years, from the time he was 18 till he was 26, during which time he didn't see women at all. Part of his pledge was to be a monk and to just not talk to women at all. So when he was 26, those are prime years generally for dealing with women, between 18 and 26. So when he came back to the United States, he had just missed the whole period of time when men and women, you know, we're all equal, everything is the same, there's no difference between us and all that. And he missed all that. He came back and he looked around and he says, what are people talking about? There's these big differences. And he just simplistically, in some way, but also fundamentally, laid out some principles that he noticed. And he agreed with me that he would never have noticed that if he hadn't been taken away from it for such a long period of time during that period, and then come back and seen it, and he dropped all the ideas from before, and then he wrote down his observations about that.
You know, I wanted to comment on the cheating or the getting by in education, and from my own personal experience with my students in Indiana, they betrayed a craving for learning. Those students who worked full time, went to school full time, generally had families at home, they were so well prepared. They craved learning. And it was, extremely rewarding for those of us who were teaching those students. But I think I had one plagiarized paper in 17 years of teaching at that university, that I knew of, at that university campus. And the young woman who plagiarized the paper was devastated. I think she didn't get that point, but anyway, just that thing about learning will out. If you really want to learn, you're going to find a way to learn, as has been shown across the ages.
Yeah, and I think it's another thing about education. There's a whole different issue of education. I think it would work a lot better for especially rambunctious young boys who aren't quite ready to sit down in class all day. You know, if you just let them do sports all but 2 hours a day until they're about 10 years old. They'd catch up in 2 seconds anyway, yep. and really wouldn't miss anything, and they would have a lot more fun, and the teachers who have to teach them would have even more fun.
Thanks for the wisdom on that one.
Okay, other questions for Patty here.
With just a couple of exceptions, we've been talking primarily about the Western world.
Yes.
Do we have any insider information to add on the non-Western world?
Very little, because, of course, I wasn't allowed to study it. But I have 2 points. One is about Poland that I actually meant to mention. When Poland was, I believe, a province of Russia, they had something called the Flying University. and Polish scholars covertly taught women. And one of the most important women that they taught was Marie Curie. I have not studied the Quran. I really didn't address. But 622, I think the declarations at Medina, which codified much of what Muhammad did. The Quran explicitly instructs that girls and boys be educated equally. And, of course, Muhammad was influenced by his own wives, who were important in business and in other ways. So I'm not really versed in the Quran at all, except I did note that it specifically instructed that girls be educated. And I believe that later on, as in many cases, cultural influences then began to restrict the education of girls.
I think that's accurate, and that's just obviously one of other cultures. But it's also important when you're studying any kind of thing in history is to have it within the context of its time. You know, what was the setting? Was it an advance towards what we would prefer, or was it a regression? It depends upon where it was before. And the Quran and Muhammad's culture that he tried to establish was an advance on women's rights at that time among the tribes that he was working with. So it was a progress. It doesn't look like progress if it stays the same way after another 1,500 years of progress in other places. But it's important, I think, to understand if you say, oh, Muhammad was against women, but actually in his time, he thought he was moving things forward. There's been education in all cultures of women at different times, but as you said, a lot of the time the education is just basic in order to get them into the role that is desired. But that's been true mostly for men, and it's also true in many cultures today which have religious or theocratic aims. Then they want the education, but they want it to be aimed at what they're trying to mold the population to be. And I don't think we have very much experience with just real democracy where we let everybody kind of try to pursue what they want. Mm-hmm. And to have all different aims in the same society at the same time, and that, you know, one group over here might be creating a little bit of a polygamous offshoot of the Mormon religion, and another one would be doing this, and so on. So there's all different varieties of things which people are doing all at the same time. And that ferment often leads to, you know, more education for everybody, actually, because there's so many differences instead of all one thing. So it's very hard to judge how well it's doing, but I think it's pretty easy to say that education has spread a lot. At the same time, there's a lot of people that they then say, okay, well, if there were only, you know, 200 people that had PhDs in the world, then a PhD meant one thing. And when there are, you know, 100,000 people who have PhDs, then it means something different. And that's a normal thing that shifts over time. And it certainly, any time you take something which is an elite function or a very small part of the population and expand it out to the whole country and the whole population, it will not be of the same quality as it was in that small group. It's just natural. Right. It's a funny thing. It's true with television, too. It's a total aside, but it's a very good indicator. Brazil, for some reason in Brazil, television hadn't really spread to the poorest 50% until the early 1990s. And television shows had been aimed at the upper 50%, you know, before that. And as soon as television became so cheap that it just went everywhere, then the shows went downhill as well in order to get the rest of the population. And, you know, there are a lot of people who look back at television in the early 50s and say the golden age of television, when it was all intelligent and so on and so forth. And, you know, if you watch some of the shows, you will find that wasn't true, so that the facts aren't all accurate. But it was also just 3% of the population that could afford TV at that time. And so, of course, their interests, you know, I mean, the same 3% are still watching opera on TV. But that was, you know, that's no longer the main thing of TV, and it's not because TV has gone downhill. It's because the population of who watches TV and what they want to watch has changed. It's these facts are very easy to get wrong, you know, when you don't look at the context. So 7 o'clock, we have time for 2-3 more questions.
You mentioned economics, and I can remember growing up, and my mother was not college educated. And there was always this issue of you had to work to make money. And So when you look at the Great Depression that we had in this country, do you feel that set back the women's movement as far as getting educated, or you think it might have evolved more quickly? And it just the whole economic issue and part of the economic issues we're going through now in our economy, will that have some effect on people being less educated?
I don't know the answer to that. George, do you want to?
I'll try a little bit on that one. I think not so much the Depression as the war.
Yeah.
That 3 million men left the country, and then they all came back at the same time. And
fired all the women.
It opened up a lot of doors to women to do jobs that people thought they couldn't do during the war. So there were a lot of, manual labor jobs that women hadn't done before that they did because there weren't any men around. But it also was, let's get back to normal. There was a big let's get back to normal, which is why there was a baby boom. But let's get back to normal, and the normal is the man works and the woman takes care of the family, and that normal idea wasn't completely accurate. But it was the image that they had. And I know my whole family, all my uncles and aunts, got back to normal real fast. So I think that was a big part of it. But at the same time, there was enough of an opening left over from before that when the 60s came and the kids, Patty was just right at the beginning of that period of time. But, if I take my older sisters versus my younger sisters, by the time my younger sisters, were in, I have one who has a PhD and teaches as a professor. And another one who's a screenwriter. So, and the other three are all well-educated, but not quite with the same drive. Same thing with athletics for women. There was no athletics for women for the three older ones. The two younger ones were both athletes. And there's no genetic difference, obviously. So I think that's a period of time, a big shift. And the difficulty, of course, is that it doesn't always just stay the same. There's always influences. But I don't think that this, what I would call a sideways economy, as opposed to, a severe cutback. But the sideways economy is mostly due to a little bit of a demographic issue more than anything else. We have an aging population. Aging populations don't buy as much as they did before. We have a consumer economy. It's come maybe 5 years earlier than it would have because of the mess with the finances. But I think it would have come, the sideways economy would have come early anyway. It would have come in 5 years anyway because that's what's happened in Japan. They have an older economy than we do. It's already happened in Europe. And I think that's just something we have to figure out. It's a totally different issue. We have to figure out, using our education, I hope, of how to deal with non-growth economies. Because we don't want the population to keep growing, right?
So, and I can tell you that, at least in the campuses that I'm familiar with pretty poor students, they are going back to school in this environment, and the enrollments are just bursting.
One last question for anyone? Okay. Thank you very much, Patty. That was a great lecture. And we'd also like to thank our audience here at the club, as well as those listening on the radio or online. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Found it.